Well, welcome everybody. Welcome to the launch of this LSE Economic Diplomacy Report, which is going to be launched today to be published. And just to say who I am, as you can see, Professor Michael Cox, founding director of LSE Ideas. I've been associated with this project from the very beginning with our good friend Professor Linda Yu, who is also a visiting professor at LSE. And I also want to thank all of the people who have been involved in this report over the last 2 to 3 years. Much more would be said about them later on. Let me just say two things very, very brief before I hand over to Linda. Firstly, about LSE Ideas. It was created by myself and Professor Arnie Westad, who's now at Yale, back in 2008, as a think tank, as a way of bringing expertise in the policy world together. As you can see, we're still going in the year 2021, and we're very pleased with the work that we have done over the many years that we've been in existence. And this is one of many, many projects in which we have been involved, which I think have had a real impact on the world out there. We had a drugs report many years ago. We also looked at British foreign policy many years ago. So this stands in what I'd like to call a long tradition of LSE Ideas intervention and involvement in the policy world to make concrete recommendations, real world recommendations for the real world. And we certainly hope that you pick up some of these in your discussions and debates in the policy world. The second thing I'd like to say just very, very briefly is how wonderful it's been engaged in a very, very big question. We started this about 2 years ago, 2 or 3 years ago. We formally launched it in some respects when Bob Zelick, I'm sure all of you know, came and gave a wonderful presentation and talk at the LSE in October of 2019. He's been a big supporter of this project as well. It's got a transatlantic, a trans-European, and I'd also like to say an Asian dimension as well, as it needs to, because of some of the fundamental questions which are facing British foreign economic policy going forward. But it's been a long time in the making. We've made many visits, and as I think you now know, in the age of Zoom, you can bring many more people into the conversation from around the world. And I think that has made an enormous difference to the quality of this particular report. So that's all I want to say, just to welcome you on behalf of LSE, welcome you particularly on behalf of LSE Ideas, to thank everybody who's been involved in this project and to recommend this report to you, which I think says many, many things very, very well. And it does it briefly, so it can be read very, very quickly. And I think, therefore, we're very much hoping this is going to have a major impact. So that's all I want to say. Just now hand over to Linda Yu, who's been the real driver behind this report. Linda, over to you.
Thank you very much, Mick. As chair of the commission, I do want to add my welcome to all of you for joining us as we launch this report. So as Mick said, the work, this big question, how you refine the UK's economic diplomacy to suit the 21st century world, began a couple of years ago. And over the course of this project, we have had 9 evidence sessions across the UK. We've heard from experts from the UK and indeed from around the world. The Commission today makes 10 actionable recommendations, which I'll introduce in a moment. But first, I want to give you the running order. So if I could have the next slide or the previous slide, please. So what we will do is after me will be Stephen Paduano, who has been a wonderful executive director for the commission. He will present the key recommendations from the report, followed by reactions, remarks from 2 external speakers who were delighted will be sharing their thoughts with us. Lord Mark Sedwell, as you can see, he was the former cabinet secretary and national security advisor. And among his many hats now, he is currently the chair of the G7 panel on economic resilience. We'll also then hear from Dr. Adam Marshall. He's Director General of the British Chambers of Commerce, with 53 chambers across the UK representing local business networks and 70 British chambers across the world. So we're delighted to have their input with their experience and their leadership in the public and the private sectors to join this conversation about our work and recommendations. We'll also try to get in some Q&A, so please put your questions in the Q&A box and we'll try and pick up those towards the end if time permits. Now, if I can have the next slide. I want to, on behalf of the LSE Ideas, the team, to thank the commissioners, the 18 commissioners who have put this report together, our experienced practitioners and leading academics who have made this a rich report that covers a wide range of subjects: economics, security, foreign policy, environment, international relations, business, to name a few. And they didn't just sit on this commission, but they designed and led the evidence sessions. The quality of this report is down to this group. So we can't thank the commissioners enough. I believe many of you, if not all, are actually with us here today for your time, your expertise, and your enthusiasm and your commitment. I also want to thank the 46 expert witnesses who we heard from, who gave generously of their time. And I know that several are also with us here today. So we thank you for contributing to this massively important question for the UK. Now, if I could have the next slide, please. I want to just introduce the key themes in the report and then the framework, and then hand over to Stephen. So what we aim to do in this report, which is titled UK Economic Diplomacy in the 21st Century, is to think about how to position the UK optimally in the 21st century global economy. We are proponents of a rules-based international system to facilitate free and fair trade. And we also, in the report, suggest that economic diplomacy is practiced at the multilateral, plurilateral, and bilateral levels. So that's the overall stance the Commission took in terms of this issue. And if I could have the next slide, the framework that we used which is around the recommendations that you'll hear today, takes those themes and tries to organize them in, roughly speaking, this sort of framework from which the recommendations flow. So what we do is we integrate economic and non-economic policies. So we align commercial openness with foreign policy aims broadly defined. So you'll see in the recommendations, there's a very large section on the importance of global public goods, particularly the environment and also, of course, health and global rules. So not having a separation, in fact, having an alignment between aims, economic and non-economic, is one of the parts of the framework. The second one is to align foreign with domestic economic policy. So in other words, integrating trade and investment policy and the UK's global role with domestic economic priority. So in other words, all economic policy is domestic as well as foreign. So removing that silo and that separation allows for trade and investment and global policies around foreign economic policies to be aligned with and support domestic strategic growth priorities, whether that's greening the economy, whether that's raising productivity. What that also does is that it allows the domestic redistributive mechanisms to be used to help address the distributional impact of those who do not benefit as much and others that get left behind when you have globalization and trade and investment policy. So what that does is that it allows for a greater cohesiveness between how you address some very complicated factors between not just trade and globalization, but automation and the growth of the services sector, how you address that both in terms of foreign and domestic policy, making sure that you are recognizing and then mitigating any negative distributional impact. And that's been a strong theme, as you'll see throughout the report, that it needs to be, it needs to work for all parts of society, across the UK. So we've got a number of recommendations around that. So I'm going to hand over to Stephen and just say he's going to introduce, we won't have time to go through all of those, but he's going to introduce one key recommendation from each of the three groupings in the report. So the first set of recommendations, the first three, is under the UK's trade and investment policy. The second grouping is around the UK's global role. And the third grouping is around UK institutional reforms in order to effectuate this economic diplomacy framework to suit the 21st century world. So with that, I'm going to hand over to Stephen and ask for the next slide.
Thank you, Linda. Hi, everyone. I'm Stephen Paduano. So I'm going to go through these, an overview of these recommendations, and we've highlighted one recommendation per theme. So the theme starts with the trade and investment policy, and here what we've chosen to highlight is forging a hub for services. So services account for 80% of the UK's output, 85% of employment. And as we note here, trade in services has grown measurably faster than trade in goods over the past decade and a half. And the pandemic may have dented this, but these trends are projected to continue. And one of the key obstacles we identify is the lack of bilateral and multilateral services liberalization. So for that reason, we encourage various measures you can see in the report around bilateral services liberalization in the way of creating a hub, as we say, or a conduit for services trade between countries, between economies which don't have FTAs with each other. But a more immediate and globally material actionable way of going about this is through the Trade and Services Agreement. So this was launched in 2013. It stalled during the Trump years, but it brings together 22 economies plus the EU, which represents 70% of the global services market. And it's plurilateral. So it's starting with those who choose to participate. And this really eases the process of achieving, you know, more substantial multilateral liberalization efforts. So liberalization in this sense, services liberalization through TISA, this will be very important for the global services market. It will be especially important for service-oriented economies like the UK's. But we should also note that it, you know, this is not to leave behind trade in goods or a manufacturing sector or anything of that nature. Some research that we highlight in the report discusses the trade enhancing effects, the trade in goods enhancing effects of services liberalization. So it's our view that a global hub for services will help promote many of these diverse goals. So second, we have, and you can see more about this in the report, non-economic track and trade negotiations. This revolves around cross-cutting issues in trade, largely in the coordination of certain dual-use technologies and other emerging economic and technological issues, and also the designation and stress testing of systemically important supply chains to make sure, you know, after the experience of the US-China trade war, the departure from the European Union, and COVID-19, to make sure that nationally sensitive supply chains are able to absorb a variety of exogenous shocks. And the next slide, please. So our second theme is the UK's global role. And this as a theme revolves around global public goods in the economics terminology, non-rivalrous, non-excludable, in practice in the international system, subject to a great degree of geopolitical rivalry, and unfortunately falling victim to unnecessary peripheral gridlock. So first, we encourage certain partnerships to promote global rules and standards, and these predominantly relate to, again, converging on various technological rules and norms shared between advanced democracies. Our second policy recommendation here relates to establishing a global public goods secretariat. And it's the Commission's view that this ought to be embedded in the G7 or G20. And the idea here is that the international system, as we say here, has been frayed. And there's a tremendous amount of congestion around issues that do not need to be obstructed by sort of the core geopolitical tensions in the international system. So a good example relates to public health or climate change, where China has pledged to increase wind and solar power by 300 and 500% in the coming decades. These are good things that are being undertaken unilaterally, and as a result, not as effectively as if they could be undertaken multilaterally in the international system. So the view is that a global public good secretariat can keep the foot on the pedal, so to speak, of multilateral progress, and at the same time, relieve that congestion in the international system and foster more trust between otherwise antagonistic parties. And our last policy here is for leadership in climate diplomacy and green markets. Please do consult the report on this one. There's lots that we say about minilateral fora and a carbon border adjustment, which would go a long way to serving these global public goods roles while also retaining manufacturing industries in the United Kingdom, not losing them as a result of carbon leakage or, you know, non-preferential tax policy at home. And the next slide, please. So this is our final theme, and it relates to institutional change. So preparing the domestic and government space for a new era of economic diplomacy. So it starts with conducting impact assessments of trade and investment policy. The idea here being to be able to measure and mitigate various trade shocks, which we know and understand may result from a new era of trade agreements. And the point is that distributional assessments will be very helpful for government fiscal policy making, which ties into the second one, upgrading trade adjustment assistance. Trade adjustment assistance here being providing support for people in the United Kingdom to handle this new era of economic diplomacy and the trade shocks that may result from it. So we encourage a human capital tax credit, which would encourage upskilling and labor investments, as well as a trade adjustment assistance tax credit, which will help firms free up and deploy capital towards more productive uses in the event of displacement due to trade. And then following consultations with national and local authorities and civil society leaders last year, we have several measures to decentralize foreign direct investment policy. And again, you can read more about those three in the report. And then finally, the policy we're highlighting here is expanding institutional capacity. So the first is to embed strategic advisory groups, and these already exist in the Department for International Trade and others. But the Commission had many conversations over the course of the past year about diverse problems, managing the rise of certain anti-trade impulses, winning the enduring support of the public for foreign economic policies, which sort of the lesson of Brexit is that this is, you know, something that should be pursued more vigorously. And then also incorporating expert stakeholders into the conduct, into the process of economic diplomacy. So our view is that embedding these strategic advisory groups, and we outline where and how they should be in the report, would be very helpful for this. Creating a cadre of economic diplomats as well, to be able to bring in people from the FCDO, HM Treasury, the Department for International Trade, BIS, DEFRA, and making sure that they can benefit from more departmental interchange and more formal secondments to the IMF, the World Bank, the WTO, and others. And then finally here, we have the establishment of a central coordinating body. And throughout the report, we discuss a whole of government approach, which is necessary for the conduct of this new, you know, economic diplomacy agenda. So embedding it within the Cabinet Office, we believe we'll be able to support and manage the process that we've outlined here and the policies that we listed above. So with that, please do give the report a read, as has been mentioned. It is short, but thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, Stephen. I'd like to now invite Lord Mark Sedwell to give his comments and reflections on the report. Mark, the floor is yours.
Well, thank you, Linda. Thank you very much indeed for including me in this event. It's a really substantive report, but as Professor Michael Cox pointed out earlier, also brief, which is a welcome innovation in reports of this kind, and one I hope we can replicate when we put our proposals to the G7 leaders from the panel that I'm chairing in June. I can assure you and colleagues that we will not be producing a 100-page report with dozens and dozens of recommendations, but we'll be seeking to replicate the effect of this report by producing a few recommendations that, if properly implemented, could have a significant impact. And I congratulate you on that. Really distinguished group of commissioners, equally distinguished group of expert witnesses. And you managed to get, as you said, a great deal of input into this that you've then been able to crystallise. One of the big existential questions of our age, of course, there's the US-China rivalry, the Thucydides trap and all of that. But one of the existential questions is essentially, are we going to respond to the pressures that have arisen in the global market system? We've seen those essentially illustrated, but not created by the COVID economic crisis arising out of the health crisis. We saw it a decade ago after the financial crisis. Is the response to that going to be essentially protectionist, or are we going to find ways of underwriting the globalized model, the global market system, through the kind of rules-based, free and fair interventions that you set out in this report? And we all know the temptations to drift towards protectionism. We've seen that in the response to COVID, particularly where supply has been constrained, whether that's for PPE or more recently for vaccines. And the political pressures are intense. The other point is that the political pressures are also intense, as you suggest in the report, to protect the jobs and livelihoods of people whose industries are subject to technological change, or where globalization means some of those jobs are moving offshore. And we've seen in the past the errors of government policies in the UK and more widely, when we essentially sought to intervene to shore up sunset industries rather than, as you suggest in the report, applying an intelligent approach to the distributive impact of globalization by equipping people to benefit from new skills, new jobs in sunrise industries where there's a real comparative advantage. And so I particularly welcome this report as an economist and and as a convinced advocate of the free trade system, recognizing that, as in any market system, the global market system that we now have does require intelligent regulation in order to ensure that it's operating effectively. And I think you have some really important ideas in that. The alternative is that we drift into protectionism. And that's not just protectionism between those who might see themselves as ideological adversaries, the West versus some of the authoritarian capitalism from wherever it emerges. But actually, as we've seen in the past few years, protectionism in the end still involves protectionism within the Western community and between countries that are allies. And that is a profoundly dangerous path should we head down it, and I very much hope that we won't. The UK's commitment to the global free trading system, as we've now left the EU and are one of the big independent advanced economies, is an important part of our G7 leadership. I think what you've done well here is to blend, of course, you'll those of you who know of my work when I was in government on the fusion doctrine and so on, you've absolutely applied that same kind of philosophy, reminding us that economic security is a critical part of national security, and that the economic agenda is entirely entwined not only with the security agenda but with the environmental agenda, and of course globally with the development agenda as well. We must remember that it is in providing access to people from developing countries, particularly over the next several decades, when in sub-Saharan Africa they will be the only part of the world without an aging population, providing economic opportunity, access to our markets, access to technology is critical to our agenda to support those countries as well. And I particularly like the way you've blended the domestic and the international for the reasons that I've set out. In the G7 panel, as I said, we'll try and follow your example and be substantive and brief. We're going to look at supply chains and the risks to those, the pinch points and bottlenecks that we've seen in those, again, illustrated by, but not caused by COVID. We're going to look at the international rule book, and we're going to look at questions of industrial policy, investment policy, technology, and so on. And I think all of those topics are going to be well informed by this report, because on all of them, one can take either a protectionist, sort of nationalistic view, often hidden behind all sorts of attractive phrases, or we can ensure that true resilience and the guarantees that our citizens will benefit from both the jobs that come with globalization, but also counting on what they need, whether it's in supply, whether it's in access to services, whether it's in a service-based economy, having access to the rest of the world, comes from ensuring that those global markets, that global market system is operating effectively with not only is rules-based, but is rules applied and enforced. And that needs to be part of the agenda as well, as your report sets out. I think this year is a really important year for the UK to show some of that global leadership and to display the economic statecraft that your report calls for, with the G7 presidency, working with the Italians on COP26 as they have the G20 presidency, and of course continuing to develop our own big bilateral relationships, new trading arrangements and so on, including new elements of trade, rather than just the classic visible trade that most free trade deals in the past have focused on. There's a big opportunity for us to lead both in those institutions and by example. We're an economy that is three quarters of consumption and demand, three quarters of services on supply, and three quarters of our assets are intangible. And so your report is essential for all economies of that kind, but particularly essential for the UK, and I look forward to working with others to understand, apply, and hopefully play some part in implementing its recommendations. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mark. So much I could say to that, except thank you, and we look forward to working with you on the G7 panel. I really appreciate it. And all the endorsements about the report being concise is like music to our ears. I'm looking at Stephen. We're very happy to hear this. So thank you. And with that, I'm going to hand over to Adam.
Linda, thank you very much indeed. And I think I'll add my congratulations to Mark's on the report itself. I think it's a model of clarity and of brevity in a world where too often complexity in economic reports and in academic reports seems to be privileged over precision. So well done to the commissioners, to the LSE, and to you all for it. For those of you whom I don't know, I run the British Chambers of Commerce. And I suppose our perspective on this is as a private sector actor with local business communities all across the UK, and also now 70 British business communities with 16,000 member companies in markets all around the world. So Chambers of Commerce have been intimately involved in international trade, in some cases for hundreds of years. And we have a strong feel for how the UK is perceived amongst our trading partners, including both private sector businesses and, of course, other governments as well. When I read through the report, six themes really came into my mind. So I'd like to raise six points with you today on this excellent report, if I may. Three of them are points of absolute agreement. Two of them are points where I'd point out some concerns with the recommendations as they have been made. And then one is about an area which could do with some further exploration, perhaps in the post-commission phase. So on those points of agreement, first of all, absolute support from our business communities for what's cited in the report as a clearly defined and consistently applied framework covering trade, foreign, and domestic policy. Businesses always tell us that they want a long-term and holistic UK economic and global strategy. But forgive me, I think that business people are extremely skeptical that the government, or indeed that the British political system as it's currently structured, can actually deliver this. We feel that we've been bruised many times by Westminster's sort of time-honored route of ad hoc and tactical decision-making, which is the enemy of that consistency and stability. I think, though, that the prize is absolutely the right one, that clear long-term strategy, which would really engender business confidence here at home and underpin international and global investment in this open economy for many decades to come. So you have our absolute support on that. The second area of absolute agreement for me would be around the importance of the focus on services and data on the one hand and climate change and green markets on the other. As an independent country with its seat at international organizations, now these are two areas where the UK can press forward plurilaterally and hopefully multilaterally as well, in addition to what it's trying to do in its domestic trade agreements. And I think more of our businesses can then benefit from the resulting liberalization. I'll add myself to those who are guilty of focusing far too much on goods in the past when thinking about trade. That might have something to do with the 20 billion plus of goods that chambers facilitate across borders every year, but goods are not the whole of the story, as you rightly said, Stephen, and that the opportunities are in services, and I think we need to seize them. The third area of great agreement for me, I really cheered to the rafters when I read the argument that perceptions of the UK by overseas governments and economic actors matter hugely to trade outcomes. So when I travel to British chambers around the world, I've lost count of the number of times our members in market have said to us that the amount of business they do with the UK is driven by the perception that the UK is a country where honesty, the rule of law, institutions and a clean business culture prevail. So accentuating our values and our reputation in these areas will be really, really important as we move out of the pandemic. And importantly, as we move out from under the shadow of Brexit, you know, our handling of that has done harm to those perceptions. I think we have to acknowledge that fact and work very hard to reestablish them, because that is the basis on which so many of our friends and partners want to trade with us. On to my two points of concern. The first is around the proposals on supply chain security. Obviously supports the importance of diversification and the importance of ensuring that long and fragile supply chains don't become the enemy of the UK's future success. But my concern is that the stress testing that's being proposed could feel like great public policy insurance, but it could feel like regulation or additional cost burdens for the businesses that are concerned, particularly when they're already dealing with additional trade barriers and higher costs right now. So a burdensome process could impact on them, and it could also impact on investment. So my question would be, how could businesses be supported and incentivized to run diversified and resilient supply chains? Could you adopt a carrot rather than a stick approach on supply chain security? My second area of concern is around the decentralization of trade promotion. I think over the years, I've seen the good and the bad here, and I would reserve judgment on whether businesses would welcome a more devolved or localized approach. The UK has often appeared pretty uncoordinated and lacking in a coherent approach to major trade fairs and events and missions around the world. And people always raise with us competing parochial delegations pitching for Bristol or Cardiff or for Edinburgh or Dundee to bemused global investors who really probably couldn't identify the distinction between those two places. And they're just thinking about how they engage with the UK itself. So whilst businesses are some of the biggest boosters and backers of place, many also welcome a one UK approach when it comes to major investment and new export partners, and would question whether a fully decentralized approach could deliver the desired results. So I think that's another point for debate. And then finally, just one thing that I think I would have liked to have seen more on, and perhaps could be part of the post-commission phase, more discussion of the role of economic diplomacy in sealing business-to-business deals, not just government-to-government trade agreements and frameworks. I think this is an area where some countries, and France is always the one that comes to my mind, genuinely excel. Their governments actively support business-to-business deals. And the commercial diplomacy, as you put it in one part of the report, is core to what they do. And I hope that someone in future will examine in more detail the role that commercial diplomacy can play within this strategy and within this framework, because I think it matters as much, if not more, than some of the other forms of economic diplomacy that are highlighted in the report. So, Linda, thank you very much to you and to your colleagues, and I very much look forward to engaging with the discussion and whatever process comes next.
Lovely, Adam. Thank you very much. And terrific points, and you've given us more homework for this project to take forward, which is also lovely to hear. You've raised thank you. And these are all, you know, excellent points and very thoughtful, just like Marx. I think you did pose two questions. I know there are questions coming in on the Q&A. So perhaps I'm going to turn to Stephen to pick up the two questions initially, and then I'll add to it, and then pick up the questions that's come in the Q&A. If you'd like to ask a question of this panel, don't limit it to me, Mick, and Stephen. Feel free to ask Mark and Adam as well. Pop your question into the Q&A box and we'll come to those. So Stephen, let me hand over to you in terms of Adam's questions around supply chains and decentralization. My quick kind of comment as I hand over is, you know, I think the partial decentralization of foreign direct investment, I think, was something we propose. And the competition element has to be carefully thought through, because indeed we discussed, we don't want to race to the bottom, but we also want is to have a greater sense in terms of foreign direct investment, what the strengths and competition, competitiveness of different regions are. And the examples we give from Germany, China, and elsewhere suggest it can be an important part of leveling up if it's set, obviously, appropriately. And then on supply chains, I'll hand over to Stephen. This is one of his favorite topics. I think how you conduct it, we left open in the report. So in other words, as you know, businesses and boards do risk registers and indeed test the resilience of their supply chains already. And it's been accelerated by recent developments. So I think what this is doing is proposing something probably slightly more global in that approach, rather than a heavy regulatory approach within the UK. It's more of a coordinating. And obviously, as we say, supply chains tend to be very efficient, but they do need to, they are stressed. And Mark mentioned is something that we're all looking at. So hand over to Stephen on that one.
Thank you. So I'll start with the first question that was raised on the 2013 devolution of the Memorandum of Understanding on decentralization of foreign direct investment policy. So it's the proposal that we have, perhaps I should say it's more modest than it seems when we talk about fostering competition and decentralizing FDI policy. It's returning to that 2013 Memorandum of Understanding, which grants concurrent powers between devolved and Westminster authorities. And the point, this stems from the conversations that we had in Belfast and Edinburgh last year, where there was a lot of dissatisfaction with the fact that this memorandum of understanding has not been fulfilled from the standpoint of some of these local authorities. So this is not to say that we're calling for kind of the disaggregation of all of economic policy in the United Kingdom. It's a much more limited aim, which is to kind of make the letter of the law a reality. On the second one about supply chains. So the point on costs are well taken. If there's a carrot approach, I certainly think in the post-commission phase that you mentioned, there will be a lot of excitement about exploring that additionally or alternatively. But on the element of costs, I think that when dealing with issues of systemic importance, you know, costs have to be weighed against, you know, other negative externalities. And the precedent that we're building off of is the FSB's creation of systemically important financial institutions after the financial crisis. And that imposes costs on banks. I mean, I don't think that any banker would be particularly pleased with the process of going through annual stress testing from the Fed or any other central bank. But it's something that's important. And, you know, fortunately, we did not experience the breakdown in supply chains that was discussed, you know, at various points during the trade war or during Brexit or during COVID. But we came close, and there have been substantial bottlenecks and disruptions at various points. And figuring out a way to deal with that seems to be a crucial component of this economic diplomacy agenda. And as Linda said, much of this is left open to process of implementation. But in terms of, you know, actionable strategic guidance, something that we can follow, we were pointing to that FSB model from 2011 or so, whenever it was introduced, as something that can apply to, as we term it, systemically important supply chains.
Thank you very much, Stephen. I want to make sure we don't have a great deal of time, but I want to get through some of these questions that have come through. This is from Yassine Bachid, LSE International Strategy and Diplomacy, 2019. I know Mick is nodding there. As an important service provider, the city is surprisingly not featured in the Brexit deal. How do you see the city evolving after Brexit? This is a great question, not surprising coming from a graduate. The first recommendation was around positioning the UK as a trade hub for services. And, you know, within that, we mentioned the strength of financial services based in the City of London and in Edinburgh and elsewhere. So I think we see this as an area where you can have the UK's comparative advantage in financial and other services, which at the moment is impeded because of a lack of multilateral global trade rules with the same amount of teeth as the rules around trade in goods. So this is a real area where the UK can strengthen its competitiveness, do plurilateral as well as bilateral push in order to facilitate a better rules-based system, a more global opening of markets for services and trade. So we see this as being, you know, quite a way of thinking about how you can position the UK within a fragmented global trading system around services. The UK has actually done very well in spite of that, being the second biggest exporter of services globally and the top exporter of financial services. And what we also stress is the recent work done by international organizations is actually around how if you were to liberalize services, you boost trade in manufacturing. So in other words, there's a lot of embedded services. In the report, we give a number of statistics, including over half of the value added in manufactured exports is actually services. And right now they are being subject to, in the interest of time, I'll just say there, you look at Mode 5 services and the push to liberalize Mode 5 services with all the embedded services in manufacturing is an example of why there is quite a lot of global interest in this. And I think the UK can take a leadership role here. It's an opportunity that also plays to its strengths in financial and, I would stress, other services as well. So I think that's one of the key recommendations that we make. I think the second question comes from Michael Bates. We're on a great roll in terms of LSE, MSC, International Strategy and Diplomacy, grads 2020. Michael Bates says, Professor Yu, thank you for this excellent reporting presentations. Could you say more about how the Commission considered technology leadership, fintech, AI, as part of positioning the UK's economic diplomacy going forward? Another great question. I'm going to probably turn to Is Stephen still catching my eye? I'll turn to Stephen to say a word about recommendation four, which is around taking a leading role in global rules. Actually, I'll start, Stephen, if there's anything you want to pick up on the back of that. Is, you know, absolutely, I think when we say services trade, it's services and digital trade. The two are very interrelated. So the fact that the framework for services trade, kind of broadly defined, GATS, hasn't really been upgraded since 1995, which predates the widespread use of the internet. Obviously, there have been a number of WTO liberalization movements to work on different parts of digital and services, and there's different tracks going, but there hasn't been this kind of wholesale look. And this is where I think using the fact that UK is one of the top ICT economies in the world and has private sector expertise to help formulate guidelines and standards and norms, the UK can be very nimble and essentially look for plurilaterally for consensus around specific aspects of digital trade, data rules, regulations, get buy-in, and then by doing that, build up momentum to move towards a more global system that isn't fragmented by the different rules around tax standards from different parts of the world. Nobody thinks this is easy. but this is a real gap in terms of global economic governance. So, Stephen, I don't know if you wanted to add anything to that.
Yeah, I would just add a word on so our proposed policy recommendations 4 and 5 deal with this. So coordinated investment security reviews, this is and the sort of the national security exception at the WTO are two topics du jour, I would say, in terms of the cross-cutting dimensions of trade. So when we discuss coordinating investment security reviews, that means going back to what Linda said, creating common positions with partners. So as you'll see in the report, there's some discussion of the T10 and the D10 and these various initiatives that have been floated around. We don't comment on those in particular, but the impulse behind it, the ambition for such summits, a technology or a democracy summit among advanced economies, relates specifically to these kind of dual use issues. So a dual use technology could be 5G, it could be a social media platform, but the idea is that there are political implications of a different economic or technological phenomenon. So it's about the core point of what we considered was the coordination of these investment security reviews. But if Professor Cox, you have something to comment on this. Oh, your microphone.
Somebody, you're on mute. Has to be said at least once in every webinar.
No, I'm sorry. No, I'll pass on this one. I've forgotten enough. More questions coming through, Linda, I think. Sorry.
Yeah, no, thank you for that. Good, thank you. So I think we pretty much only have time for one last question. So this is from Peter Watkins. He is LSE Ideas Visiting Senior Fellows. He says, alongside the new coordinating body in the Cabinet Office, do we need to review the institutional boundaries between HMT, DIT, BES, DEFRA, et cetera, to achieve a more integrated approach? I think the best people to answer this are actually our invited speakers. So can I go to Adam first and then to Mark?
Thanks, Linda. No, I think Peter's asked the right question because we do have silos that businesses experience from the demand side. And of course, anyone at the heart of government trying to coordinate a clear policy has difficulty with from the supply side. The one caution that I'd bring into this is that piecemeal reorganization, which is what we've seen over the years, often to suit individual politicians' requirements rather than the needs of the economy and our global approach, don't work. And what they do is they result in work stopping on many key business or economic priorities for a year or two whilst the new arrangements bed in. So any shift in institutions or institutional boundaries needs to be well planned and executed over a long period of time, with a promise that those arrangements will then be allowed to settle in. Because my view is it takes businesses a year to hear about changes, 5 years to really engage with them, and 10 years to really feel comfortable with them and go with the groove. We need that longevity of institutions in this country if we're to achieve some of the objectives that the Commission has set out, both for the economy and for our wider global strategy.
Thank you very much, Adam. Mark, if I come to you on this recommendation of the Commission to set up a coordinating body in the Cabinet Office for Economic Diplomacy.
Thanks. Well, I agree with Adam. I mean, I think we've got to be careful that the answer to everything that requires more than one government department to work on it doesn't involve some new piece of machinery in the Cabinet Office, because it means the Cabinet Office gets larger and larger and disempowers other parts of government. And Peter Watkin's question doesn't mention the FCDO, I don't think, as an important part of this. And of course, with the merger of the old Foreign Office and DFID to create more of a development, also an economic capability in our diplomacy, the institution, or at least one of the institutions responsible for economic statecraft, as set out in the report, should be the new FCDO. And I hope they're going to build more of that capability. I agree with Adam, tinkering around with Whitehall doesn't really work. It just confuses everyone, including Whitehall itself. I'm on the record as believing, and I still believe, that we have far too many government departments. And I think if we went down to around a dozen or so, then the question would look very different, because you would probably then only have, at least in something even this cross-cutting, only a couple involved, and then it's relatively straightforward to manage the cross-government work. I think the underlying question of too many government departments, too fragmented, when you think our cabinet is twice the size of the American and four times the size of the Chinese, is a broader question, and this is just an example of it. But what they have to do is find a way of working across those boundaries. There always will be boundaries. They have to find a way of working across them, ensure their interface is not barriers, and produce a genuinely coherent, joined up government response on all of this that's able to prosecute the agenda that your report sets out.
Thank you very much, Mark. That actually leads me very nicely to the conclusion, which is of this event in this phase of the project, which is we set out strategically exactly that principle, that there needs to be a greater coordination of these issues. But we do not say in the report the procedural, the process, because that is obviously in the next phase, as it were, to do it in a way that can make sure the silos that we were proposing that are broken down, removing divisions between economic and non-economic, integrating foreign and domestic, are all properly coordinated and scrutinized within government. And so in terms of the coming months, your comments, both Mark and Adam, have been hugely helpful, as we will be discussing disseminating these recommendations and also how to implement these, because obviously lots of procedures and process still need to be properly discussed and formulated. And there's only so much we can do in one report. So with that, I hope that we have contributed to refining the UK's economic diplomacy agenda to make the most of the opportunities and address the challenges of the 21st century world. So in conclusion, I'm just going to say thank you to all of our speakers for really thoughtful contributions, and really, we'll take the praise on the conciseness of the report again. And I also want to thank the LSE IDS team, particularly Gideon Gotel, who's not with us and right now, who's managed the project, and Guy Munson, as well as IDS, who have kindly supported this work. And then of course, Stephen, as our executive director, and Mick, who's been a lovely partner in the work of this commission. And of course, to all the amazing commissioners who have made this project fun to work on, even as we tackle the big challenging questions of the day. So with that, you can see on the screen, and it's also in your chat, you please, we hope you'll download and read the report from our website. You can access it either through the LSE Ideas webpage itself, go to projects, or just click on the link in the chat. And thank you all for joining us. Thank you for your terrific questions. And we're very pleased to have marked the launch of this report with such a stimulating and thoughtful webinar. So thank you all.